California's multi-year drought shows no signs of letting up, and farms are by far the biggest consumers of water. The U.S. Geological Survey estimates that a quarter-pound hamburger requires 450 gallons of water to produce, and according to the EPA, agriculture accounted for 9% of the total U.S. greenhouse gas emissions in 2013. A growing number of experts agree that in order to address these issues, we will need to change our meat-eating habits. So, for today's Please Explain, we're talking all about the future of meat, and joining us are two guests who are heavily invested in changing how we think about meat. Ethan Brown is the CEO of Beyond Meat, based in Los Angeles, and Mark Post is the head of Cultured Beef, a program at the Maastricht University in the Netherlands. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And we invite our listeners always on these Please Explain segments to join the conversation. You can call us at 212-433-9692. Write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Ethan, tell us a little about what you sell at Beyond Meat.
Sure. So what we do is we take the constituent parts of meat, which are basically five different things. You have the amino acids, you have lipids, you have carbohydrates, you have minerals, and you have water. We take those all from non-animal, plant-based sources, and we put them into the architecture of meat, and then we sell that in the supermarket. So we sell a beef and chicken product that's made entirely from plants.
But that have the same kinds of qualities that the meat ingredients would have?
Correct. Our goal really is to allow people and enable people to continue to consume what they love, whether they love burgers or bolognese or tacos, and to have all the nutritional benefits of meat, which are many, but not have any of the downside, such as cholesterol, such as the emissions that go along with meat production, et cetera. So we are in the business of enabling people to continue to eat meat and continue to enjoy all the dishes they like, but simply have a better form of meat, a meat that's been made directly from plants.
Well, how is this different from what we used to see in the past, or still see in some vegetarian restaurants, where you get a mushroom hamburger that is like beef?
Right. That's a great question. So, and one that I've suffered through the answer of that for years, because I would go to restaurants and watch my date or friend have a wonderful meal, and I'd have a plate of vegetables. And so I've definitely been there. So what we do is something different. We are actually investing to create meat directly from plants. And so we're spending millions of dollars a year to bring together the right scientific team to find the exact sources that we need to then go ahead and put those through a very simple process of heating, cooling, and pressure to provide a product that has the same architecture as animal protein, but it's simply been made from plants. So it's very different from taking a soybean and having that soybean be contorted to behave like a steak. This is actually finding the blueprint of meat and then taking those core parts of meat from plants and constructing them in the same architecture as a piece of meat that people are so familiar with.
And Mark, you're taking a totally different approach to meat. What's cultured beef?
Cultured beef, the goal is exactly the same as Eden's, but we indeed take a different technology. We use the stem cells that are sitting in all our muscle waiting to repair tissue in case of injury, and they can repair and replace muscle tissue just as we know it, and they can also do that outside of the body. So that's exactly what we're doing. We're taking those cells through a small sample out of the muscle, then culture them, multiply them, and then use their innate capacity to form those tissues, but now it's outside of the body. And then we assemble those tissues, we harvest them, we assemble them, and put them in a patty, and basically that's how we created that hamburger.
So no animal dies in the process of making real meat?
No animal has to die in that process, yes.
Has anyone attempted to do this before you did?
Actually, yes. It's the technology to do this has been out there for 15 years or so, but mostly applied for medical purposes and for drug testing for pharmaceutical purposes. And nobody has ever really eaten it. There has been an effort by a artist, Oren Katz, also some 12 years ago, where he created a very small piece of what he called meat. And he actually, at some point in France, built a small lab creating those pieces of meat and feeding them to a select group of people, and it all sped it out. But it was mostly part of an exhibition.
But this is different than a 3D printing approach to creating something out of other things.
Yes, it's different in that we use the self-organizing capacity of these cells to build a tissue. There are limits to that, though. The size of the tissues that we can build is really a millimeter in diameter. So that means that you are sort of stuck to processed meat or hamburgers, if you like. With this particular technology, you cannot make a full thickness steak. There are different technologies, including 3D printing, where you could do that, and also in the medical field that has been tried, a lot of times and somewhat successful, because for medical applications, you also need thick tissues.
Ethan, weren't you working with fuel cells before you got into this?
I was, yeah. And it's a similar, it's exactly the same goal in that we were working on creating an engine that ran on a fuel that was basically better for the Earth and had fewer emissions. And so as I started to learn more about the impact of livestock, and in fact, the number I would use would be 51% of greenhouse gas emissions can be attributed to livestock. It was a very thorough study done by two scientists and economists at the World Bank. I started to think, okay, why am I working so much on trying to increase the efficiency of a fuel cell when, in fact, by changing the 3 or 4 ounces at the center of someone's plate, you can make a far greater difference in terms of your contribution to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So, you know, in terms of one single action that any consumer can take today to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, to change out those 3 or 4 ounces that they consume of protein at the center of the plate from a animal meat to a plant meat.
And you'd also worked in Bosnia. Did that in any way influence your getting into the Beyond Meat business?
It's a great question, and I've never been asked that. I'm sure there is some relationship there. I think there's two ways you can look at the world. One is the world as it is, or the world as you'd like to make it. And I certainly put myself in the latter camp, that there's a lot of reason to strive to see the world that you want to live in, and you want your children to live in.
And Mark, what were you doing before you started growing beef?
I'm actually a medical doctor by training, although I didn't do a whole lot of patient care. And I was mostly in cardiovascular diseases, research on cardiovascular diseases. So I'm a blood vessel specialist, and we were tissue engineering blood vessels before we started tissue engineering muscle tissue.
So you were working on humans, and then a light bulb went off, and you said, hey, I can make beef the same way?
Sort of like that. There was actually a very interesting guy of 92, an entrepreneur who has been obsessed with this idea pretty much the last 30 years of his life. And he coerced a number of scientists, including me, to start working on this. And the moment we started working on that, I thought, well, this is actually a great idea. Pretty much like what Eaton experienced, you know, when you come across a very good application that could change the world, then go for it.
I'm speaking with Mark Post, head of the Cultured Beef Program at Maastricht University, and Ethan Brown, CEO of Beyond Meat, on today's Please Explain, a look at other ways of approaching meat other than killing the animal. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and a reminder that you can give us a call if you have any questions about what we're discussing. Our number is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WMYC.org. leonardlopate.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Ethan, Alton Brown and Mark Bittman have both said that your products are the closest thing they've eaten to meat. Was it your goal that your products would fool the palates of experts?
So that's a real blessing that they have had that experience, and it's something I'm very proud of. You know, what we're focused on is trying to collapse the gap between our products and the animal protein equivalent. And so every year our products are getting better and better. I believe we have a very good relationship with our consumer and a good trust with them that they're willing to take this journey with us. Every year these products continue to get closer. And I there's no scientific obstacle to doing what we're trying to do, which is to fully create meat from plants. I have a lot of regard for what Mark is doing and a lot of respect for him, and I'm excited for his products. And I think there's a lot of different solutions that could be in the market. So I think what we're going to see is in the future you'll see basically protein aisles in the supermarket where you have a bunch of different choices about how you can get your protein. Some will still be from animals, obviously, but you'll have more and more that come from solutions like mine or from Mark's.
Well, do you have certain flavor profiles? Can you make beef that tastes grass-fed or grain-fed?
It's a fascinating, the whole subject is so fascinating. You can, and you can manipulate the combination of amino acids and sugars and things like that to basically get different types of taste profiles that are recognizable to consumers as specific types of meat. So, yes, all of that is possible.
Now, Mark, you've gotten support from technology. I guess both of you have gotten support from investors. But in your case, Mark, didn't Sergey Brin, the co-founder of Google, make an investment?
Yes, he did, yeah.
Do you mind my asking how much he invested? It's okay. You don't have to tell me.
I was told that gentlemen don't talk about money. I do consider myself a gentleman. But it was sufficient to produce those first hamburgers and to continue doing the work in optimizing that product. So it was a substantial amount.
Didn't you
keep my lab going for 3 years or so?
Did you start attempting to make a cultured pork sausage? What led you to switch to hamburger?
Well, basically, it was Sergey Brin who made me change. He said, if it's going to be American money funded, then it needs to be a hamburger and not a sausage. And I immediately said, yes, why not? It didn't seem to matter too much to me. In retrospect, I found it a very lucky choice because, with the greenhouse gases and the food security issues being the biggest with cattle, actually beef is a very good target to start working on.
Ethan, has working with tech investors influenced how you've approached the technology in this work?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the key learning is around a worldview that suggests that the way things are aren't necessarily the way they need to be. And so to work with someone like Bill Gates or Biz Stone or Evan Williams, these people that have disrupted the industries that they've entered into, you can't help but adopt some of that same worldview.
You've also decided to tackle the burger as one of your products. You have a thing called the Beast Burger?
Correct.
What's that?
So that's an interesting product. So we said if we're going to go to the trouble of building meat directly from plants, why confine ourselves to the genetic map of any one specific species? So we created a burger that has equivalent protein, in fact, slightly more than raw beef, but also has things like omegas that you would get in salmon. It has antioxidants that you would get in blueberries, pomegranate, et cetera. So we created a more nutrient-dense source of food. And if you look at the history of meat consumption in evolution, that's what we were after when we first became carnivorous, was that more nutrient-dense source of food. We went from having to chew an enormous amount of plant matter to becoming scavengers and eating meat directly from the bone. So we wanted to continue that theme of providing consumers with a more nutrient-dense source of meat, and the reaction has been overwhelming. People have loved this product, and it's become our best-selling product thus far. And it's interesting because it doesn't exactly try to mimic beef, for example. It doesn't say, hey, this is going to taste just like a hamburger or feel just like a hamburger. But it does serve the function of providing that protein for the center of the plate in a way that's delicious and gives you a huge amount of nutrients that you couldn't get from any single meat source.
But, Mark, in your case, you're using animal protein, so it can taste just like beef?
Presumably, and you know, I share the fascination. We don't.
You might
exactly
merge companies
know.
Here.
Sorry?
I've looked very much at what he's doing, and I'm fascinated by it.
No, but it, you know, the viewpoint is exactly the same, so we are working under the assumption that consumers want to eat beef, and if you, and we all need to realize, and I think we cannot get that message across enough, that we actually don't need meat proteins, we or animal proteins for that matter. We technically don't need them, and there are 2 billion vegetarians on this planet who prove that every day. You have to have a little bit balanced diet, but you know, you can get without. So we are not really in the process of replacing animal proteins by something else. We just want to create a product that people have, over the centuries, have loved and think they cannot do without. Maybe not for the nutritional value, but more for, you know, historical, cultural, anthropological reasons. So that's what we basically set out to do. You know, hey, we can create this same stuff, but then without the cow.
Well, many vegetarians are vegetarians because they just object to killing animals to provide us with food. But in this case, we can eat real meat, and at the same time, no animal has to die in the process.
Right, right. But let me get this straight, and I'm telling that to vegetarians all the time. If because of this technology, vegetarians start to eat meat, that would be sort of an adverse side effect of this whole enterprise. Because, you know, with this technology, I don't know enough about Ethan's, whether that's the same. With this technology, it's always going to be less efficient than just eating plant proteins alone.
Let's take a call. Bob from Livingston, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Just a question for the, I'll call them nutritious vegetable patties. Not everything in the plant world is healthy for people as well. And I was wondering, since they're controlling so much of the nutrients in the vegetable burger product, whether they're controlling things like oxalate content, which is a problem for people who are prone to kidney stones, or things simple as keeping the sodium low, which is also a health problem.
Ethan?
Right. Okay, so great question. So I think the first thing that I always try to emphasize is that we use a lot of professional focus groups, a lot of man on the street sampling, but the most important and consistent focus group that I have is my own family, including my 10 and 11-year-old children. I mean, they love our products. They eat everything that comes out of our lab. So I am enormously focused and careful about the health attributes of our products. We also have on our board, we have on our scientific advisory board, have medical doctors, et cetera. So it's something that I take very seriously. I haven't, on the specific kidney stone question, we haven't focused on that. On the sodium, yes, we are very cognizant of sodium levels and do work to try to have a product that's very much reduced. But the entire purpose of our products from the health perspective is not only to not have the negative cholesterol, et cetera, but is also to provide people with things that will continue to allow them to flourish and to have more energy rather than less, et cetera. One of the sort of interesting side effects of this product is interesting things that have developed from it is athletes seem to love this Beast Burger because it allows them to continue to consume a beef-like product in terms of the amount of protein, et cetera, how satiating it is, but it doesn't inflame their joints in the same way that animal protein will. So there's a lot of things that people are finding that are both, you know, positive in terms of the attributes of the product as well as the absence of negatives like cholesterol. So it's been a really exciting product for us.
My guests on today's Please Explain look at the Future of Meat are Ethan Brown, CEO of Beyond Meat, which is based in Los Angeles, and Mark Post, head of the Cultured Beef Program at Maastricht University in the Netherlands. And we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter. My handle is at Leonard Lopate, and we'll be back with more right after this. And we are back to today's Please Explain Look at the Future of Meat with Mark Post, head of the Cultured Program, a Cultured Beef Program at Maastricht University in the Netherlands, and Ethan Brown, CEO of Beyond Meat here in the United States, actually in California, where there's real concern about how much of an impact meat farming actually winds up having on the economy. Mark, a number of people have been calling in to find out, to ask whether you could apply what you're doing to other things like faux seafood or dairy products. Could you make fish fillets the same way that you make a burger?
Right. Every animal who has these stem cells in their muscle, including fish, birds, every mammal, you can do this with, and in fact has already been done. People in Melbourne are working on fish. People in Tel Aviv are working on chicken. For all those species, there might be a different sort of reason to do it. Chicken and pigs and fish are much more efficient than cows in converting vegetable proteins into animal proteins. So that might not be the right reason, but for chicken, for instance, because, you know, we're talking about many, many more animals than living under probably even more industrialized conditions than cows. Animal welfare would be a great reason to start working on chicken.
And chickens are kept really in tight quarters, or pigs might really appreciate not having to have to live in those conditions.
Right. Absolutely.
David from Merrick. Is it Merrick Road, Long Island? Hi, you're on the air.
I said Merrick Road. Okay.
Go ahead, David.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes. What's your question?
My question is about kosher certification. Have you inquired into being able to certify these products as kosher, and more importantly, parva? I think where you the process that uses vegetable products to make meat products, that one probably would be an easy task. But the one with the stem cell, that was what you said, you use stem cells to convert food into plants, into animal
right.
protein.
So, Mark, that would still be a beef product. That would still be a meat product.
Right, because it's derived from the cell.
It would still be a meat product, and we have talked to rabbis and halal experts about this, and because rabbis, if they ever can agree on anything, they do agree that it could be kosher, because if the number of steps in between the really harvesting of the cells and the final product is large enough, and all those steps are adhering to kosher principles, then the final product can be kosher, even if the original source is not. For halal, it's interesting, because if you don't slaughter animals, the halal principles no longer really apply, although during the whole manufacturing process, there are halal principles as well, in terms of being really responsible how you not only treat the tissues and treat the products, but also treat your employees. So the final answer is yes, it can be kosher, and yes, it can be halal.
And in the case of what you're doing, Ethan, it definitely would lead to a situation where people could eat what might be thought of as meat, and mix it with dairy.
Yeah, it would be parva.
Correct. Yep.
So
that's absolutely right.
Does that answer your question, David?
Yes, it does. I only have one more. You were already alluding to it, but the pork product might have a larger potential than the beef, even.
So if you're ever in the Los Angeles area and want it, we have a sausage that's that's sold by a pizza chain here that is absolutely phenomenal, and it's going to be offered next year in retail. And it's something that that it does exactly that. It allows people that have that concern around mixing dairy and meat to enjoy a good sausage pizza.
So let's talk about that. Has there been talk about selling these things at supermarkets? Is McDonald's asking about meat alternatives? Are these going to be a little more expensive because they involve complicated technologies?
Why don't I answer the just the first question? We do have a lot of interest from what we call quick serve restaurants, so it'd be those chains. And as you would imagine, it's the more progressive ones that are leaning forward first. And so it's my hope that next year you'll see some pretty exciting announcements from us along those lines. But you know, they're also that many of the mainstay entities are fairly risk averse, and so it's going to take a long time to get this onto the menu of some of the larger fast food organizations.
I was just wondering what section of the supermarket they would put your product in. It wouldn't be in the meat department; probably have to be in the frozen food department.
Right. As we move forward, though, we are in discussions with grocers about putting our products in the meat department. And in fact, we've asked, again, the more progressive ones to consider naming the meat department the protein aisle versus the meat aisle, or the protein counter versus the meat counter, so that there's no inherent bias toward animal protein and against plant protein.
Mark, are you allowed to sell your meat in the EU or the United States?
Not yet. No, this is going to be is going to be viewed as a novel food, and thereby has to go through safety testing and safety regulation. So that will take a while.
Are you concerned about agricultural lobbyists who might make it difficult for you to bring your meat to market?
Yes, I'm somewhat concerned about that, but I think that's very regionally dependent. In certain European countries, say France, we have seen that the farmers can be pretty powerful. In a lot of European countries, that's no longer the case. In the Netherlands, for instance, there's although it's a big meat-producing country, especially pork, there doesn't seem to be a big lobby of that industry. In the U.S., I think there is a pretty big lobby. So it might be very regionally dependent, and we might need to kind of circumvent that by selecting the proper market for it.
And what about you, Ethan? Have you experienced some pushback?
There here and there, there's a little bit, but I think what I found is some of the more innovative meat companies have been actually interested in collaboration, and some of the younger farmers are looking at this as a way to generate more income per acre, because it's so much more efficient in terms of the use of land when you're growing protein directly. Like anything, you see part of the sector leaning in and some of it fighting it. So it's a mix.
Mark, on your website, you write that one cow sample could provide up to 20,000 tons of culture beef. How's that possible?
It's simply replication capacity of these cells. It's tremendous, and so they can multiply, they can double at least 50 times, if not 70. And if you do that exponential math, you arrive at those numbers. So it's just their tremendous replicative capacity to divide that makes this happen.
What's been the biggest technical challenge for you so far?
The biggest technical challenge is to scale up production, I think, and we have only recently started doing that, so we don't even know whether it's going to be a huge challenge, but in order to scale up, initially you need quite a lot of materials, and so it's capital intensive, and then the scaling process itself is somewhat unpredictable, so we need to work through that.
A couple of years ago, you unveiled the first cultured beef burger in London. How long did it take you to produce that first burger?
That took took us about 3 months. That's really, it's faster than a cow. But it's really not, it depends on the capacity of your lab. So our lab doesn't have the capacity to grow that many cells at the same time. So it takes 3 months to produce one hamburger. It also takes 3 months if you have a large capacity to grow 50,000 hamburgers.
And that burger had no fat. A lot of people like to have a certain amount of fat in their burger.
Right.
So was it really dry?
It was. I agree. And we knew that up front, but we decided not to add any plant or animal fat to it at that stage, other than, if we would be able to add cultured fat. So now we are culturing fat tissue from also stem cells that we get from the same sample. And we are... So that works. That has been described. We had to tweak that system a little bit because the way it had been described was not really compatible with food production. But you can easily find other triggers to get those stem cells to become fat cells, and that works well. What we in the process are trying to do is to coerce these cells into making more omega-3 fatty acids than they originally do. They're capable of doing that. We just have to find the right switch to let them do that.
And Ethan, your process also seems very complex. I'm assuming you made some mistakes along the way. Didn't you have an issue with an ingredient that affected your sales at Whole Foods?
So it is a complicated process, and it's one where the further you get, the more effort and resources and investment it takes to make that next incremental gain. So I'd say we're in some of our products we're 80% or so of the way there to fully providing the complete center experience of the meat that we're trying to replace, and getting that 82%, 83%, 85%. Is increasingly harder, but doable and pretty exciting to watch. On the Whole Foods thing, yes, we did. We were very committed and are very committed to providing all of our nutrients directly from plant-based sources versus using compounds, right? We utilized some plants that that were not common in the food industry and so had some GRAS status, which is generally regarded as safe. All being fine, they're sold in the supermarket, but they were not being sold as food. So we had to basically take those out and find other sources, and that was an issue for us.
And I suspect that you're going to run into similar problems along the way, even if this is what both of you are doing really could have a major impact on the planet. I can just imagine what it would mean for countries like China with its growing population and greater demand for meat. In India, people could start eating meat for the first time. Thank you both so much for being on our show. We've been talking about the future of meat with two people who have been thinking totally outside the box, Ethan Brown, CEO of Beyond Meat, and Mark Post, head of the Cultured Beef Program at Maastricht University. And thanks to all of you who have called in. Sorry we couldn't get to more of the calls. It's a fascinating subject, and I look forward to eating something that is meat and isn't meat all at the same time.
Thank you very much for having us. Appreciate it.